The Buddha talked a lot about suffering. He framed so much of the teaching around not only suffering, but the possibility of being free from suffering. At one point, he is said to have said, "All that I teach is suffering and the end of suffering." And so really his whole journey, his own path, his own exploration was motivated by this question of, is it possible to find freedom from suffering? And part of the way I understand his journey is that he came to a recognition or an understanding about what suffering is. There's so much happening in our lives, in the world. There's unpleasant experience happening in our body. There's situations in the world that are out of our control. We might call those suffering, but what I think the Buddha really found in his own mind, in his own experience, is that, yes, there are unpleasant things happening, not only physical unpleasant things, but things going on outside of us that are out of our control, that we don't like. And yet the understanding that he came to is that there's a part of our experience, a part of our what we feel is suffering that is created by our reaction to what's happening, that is not inherent in unpleasant experiences, not inherent in what's happening in the world, but it lies in our reaction to it. And he pointed to, in particular, one way of framing what the second noble truth, the first noble truth, one of the central foundational teachings of the Buddha, the first noble truth, there is suffering, the truth of suffering. And the second is craving. A way to state the second noble truth, as my understanding, craving will be found inside of all suffering. That there is the structure of how our experience of suffering comes to be is because of this inner constriction, a wish for things to be a certain way, this craving, the craving I think we often think of as being a wanting, of a leaning towards, but in this understanding it really is, I think, both the wanting things to be the way we want them to be, but also not wanting things to be the way we don't want them to be. So it includes both greed and aversion, both the pulling towards things we want and the pushing away from things we don't want. And that this reactivity in the mind is the basic structure of what we call suffering. That whenever we are experiencing suffering, there's some of that in there, that craving. And this can be surprising, actually, when we start to look at our experience directly and begin to get familiar with these various flavors of experience, you know, unpleasant experience, for instance, when we have a physical pain, when there's something that's damaged our body, there's physical pain happening. And, you know, our usual response there is to have some kind of fear, anger, frustration, anxiety, some kind of aversion to a physical pain. And yet we don't really quite understand that the suffering aspect of that experience, the entirety of the experience, is intimately connected to that aversion. And as we start to open to our experience more fully, and we begin to recognize, okay, what is unpleasant experience? What is the sensation? And how is the mind with it? This very practice that we're working with, looking at what's happening and how we are with it, we might see at times, oh, there's something unpleasant happening. Wow, there's a lot of aversion there. And we feel entangled. We feel caught there. And we know we're suffering. And yet, as we observe, as we pay attention, we might at times see that reactivity not be there. And then there's a real aha moment, because the experience of unpleasant, even very unpleasant, what we would call painful sensation, has a completely different quality when we are not reacting to it. And so this is really where the Buddha was pointing us to look at that craving. What is suffering actually? What is suffering? It is not inherent in the situation that our hearts are constricted or in pain or tight. In whatever's happening, it's not inherent that we have a reactive heart. Our heart can be peaceful no matter what the situation. That's a possibility the Buddha pointed to, that is possible. And yet what we mean by peace here, you know, I don't remember if I said this the other day or not, but you know, what we might think of when we hear the word peace is everything's fine, or don't need to do anything. You know, no need to do anything because everything's okay. That's maybe what we think peace means. But to me, the peaceful heart is the heart that is not constricted, not tight with greed or aversion, but may be inclined, because it's an open heart, because our heart is open and connected with what's happening in the world, our heart is inclined to respond when there is suffering happening, when there is oppression or injustice happening in the world. Our heart, when the heart is not constricted, it is wanting to act to alleviate that suffering. And yet, when we're caught by aversion, and we're caught by fear and confusion and anger, you know, that mind state of being caught in that way can't understand or can't fathom that there would be a reason to respond to the world that didn't include that reactivity. The reactivity has us believe that I'm the only reason you do anything. And so that reactivity has got a very myopic view of how things happen and what motivates us. And when we touch into that open heart that is unconstricted, the peaceful heart that I'm calling, there is a motivation to act when we see things in the world that are causing pain and suffering. There's a motivation to act. And so I really want to put that out right at the beginning, because so often the teaching or the understanding, when we talk about suffering is caused by craving, You know, that the if we're not really, or the suffering that, maybe we could say the suffering that we can release has craving at its root. And then with that release from that craving, we can act in the world in a way that perpetuates goodness rather than perpetuates reactivity. It's so easy to hear this teaching around the second noble truth is sometimes said, the cause of suffering is craving. And for that to be, you know, the way that can be understood is, well, if I'm suffering, it means that I'm doing something wrong. And that's not quite my sense of the teaching. It's more, you know, that there are things happening in the world. We have a habitual way of responding to that, very naturally a habitual way of responding, just based on our conditioning, based on the conditions of our life, the way that we've been, our culture has trained us, the way that causes and conditions have come together. You know, that we tend to want to push things away that are unpleasant, want to fix or change or out of this motivation of reactivity more than out of a motivation of compassion. That's our habit. That's our usual way of responding. And yet there are things happening in the world that are unethical, that are causing pain and suffering. And the teaching is not saying that it's your fault that stuff is happening. The teachings are saying that there's a way that we can, no matter what's happening, there's a way that we can have a relationship with it that creates a skillful response rather than a reaction, a reactivity. And so this dukkha that the Buddha said we could be free from is bound up with this constricted heart, this craving. There are different words that are used to translate the Pali word dukkha. Sometimes suffering is the word that's used, and it's a good word for dukkha. And yet it doesn't necessarily convey the kind of breadth of what this kind of suffering is, because when there's any kind of unease or dissatisfaction or just a sense of things aren't just not quite right, that too is dukkha. One translation, stress. Thanissaro Bhikkhu uses the word stress, which I like the translation part for a couple of reasons. One, it really points to that the dukkha that we're looking at is something that is a mental response, because stress is kind of a mental response to experience. It also points to the fact that it conveys that it is mental reactivity, and that it can be quite subtle. That it's not always some big thing, but can be just the subtlest kind of rub. You know, things just aren't quite going the way I want them to. And so the term dukkha has this range from that rub to full out, like real screaming suffering, rage and hatred. And so the pointing here about suffering and this kind of inner creation or the seed of why we suffer being craving is related to basically a misunderstanding or a sense of believing, craving basically believes that in order to be happy, then I have to get what I want and get rid of what I don't want. So that's the kind of belief or view that's underlying craving. And it's basically a mistaken view. It's very persuasive based on our experience in life, because pretty much as we've gone through life, much of the time when we go through life, the times when we are happy are when we get what we want and when we get rid of what we don't want. And so it seems pretty logical that that's when I would be happy. And so that perpetuates, again, it perpetuates this cycle because of the believing of that. And our experience seems to confirm that belief, so why should I question it? And this is where the Buddha, the brilliance of the Buddha, really, he started investigating, looking at what's going on in there, and being curious about, well, what is happening in there? You know, so when there's craving happening, what's going on, and what happens when I don't get what I want? Well, normally we would suffer when we didn't get what we want, when we wanted. But if we look at the whole structure of it, if we explore the craving itself, and maybe you could try this for something simple. For me, it was really eye-opening to explore this directly for something really simple. I was experiencing a lot of craving in one retreat to look at the people. This was a retreat, the 3-month retreat, where we were told to, you know, kind of restrain our senses, to not look at people. We're not necessarily doing that here, and so this is not necessarily an instruction for this retreat, but there may be, some of you may be noticing that people aren't looking, and that's fine. You know, what supports you? It's fine to look or not look. Probably not so useful to try to catch somebody's gaze, but in any case, we were practicing on this particular retreat with not looking at people. There was a lot of wanting to look at people. I was looking at their feet and really wanted to know what face was connected to those socks or those shoes. And I was noticing that a lot. And for the longest time at the beginning of that retreat, I was doing a kind of, blinders. It's like, I'm not going to look. They told us not to look. I'm not going to look. And so it was a craving about craving. I was forcing myself, because of rules that somebody said, kind of, you know, it's like, so they said to do this, so that's what I'm going to do. And it wasn't done with a lot of wisdom. It was just, not going to look. And at some point, I mean, it served me in a way, because at some point I really realized how much I wanted to look. I so wanted to look at people. And at some point over the course of a few weeks, it was like, oh, well, wanting is what's happening here. Rather than just trying to force myself to not look, maybe I should be curious about the wanting. And so I began to investigate that. And so this is looking at the relationship. So what was happening was I was seeing socks, and initially I was not noticing the wanting to look. Instead, I was jumping right to, not going to do that, not going to look. I wasn't really noticing that I want the wanting itself. And so I began looking at that. I began watching. What does it feel like to want? It was a very distinct experience. You know, it just felt like I was being pulled. When somebody's socks popped into the field of vision, it would be like, ooh, you know, wanting just ooh. And then the it was like, there was like a tractor beam, like trying, it's like a magnet trying to get me to look up. And I was still following the not look, but I was more interested in the whole process of looking at the wanting. So I felt into that pull. I felt it. It was painful. It hurt. It was unpleasant. That feeling of wanting was unpleasant. That's part of why we want to follow through on the wanting. It's not only to get some little hit of pleasant of something that we want. It's not only that. But it's also because when we get that hit of pleasant, the wanting goes away. And again, this is something that we've learned kind of subconsciously almost with our exploration around getting what we want, is that it feels good to get what we want. But mostly we think it feels good because we've gotten what we want, and we haven't noticed that it also feels good because the wanting has gone away. And so what this exploration began to show me was just how unpleasant the wanting was. But what I also got to see were the conditions that led to it coming into being. So socks appeared in the field of my vision. Wanting arises. Conditions, lawful conditions. And then the socks, really tempting to look up when the socks are right in front of you, and then disappear into another room. The wanting went away when the socks went away, when the person vanished from the possibility of looking, the wanting to look ended. When I experienced that, that was a feeling of being released. It's like being released from a vice grip. And in that moment, there was a deep understanding of how much suffering craving itself causes and how much it entrances us to believe the only way for there to be any kind of a release from that wanting is to follow through on it. And here the wanting vanished without needing to follow through on it. It was a remarkable understanding that came around that seeing of the wanting going away. Just the feeling of being released. Of being released from that suffering. And so I encourage you to explore for small wantings. You know, maybe you like something at the meal. You really like something at the meal, and you're kind of sitting there waiting for seconds and hoping that there's going to be some left. And, you know, maybe you could just watch the wanting there and see what happens. Take your time to see what happens as you're sitting there with watching the wanting and then feeling it maybe get stronger as you see the supper put away yogi come out and like get ready to take it away. It's like, oh, really strong. This is my last chance. And what happens if you don't follow through on it? Just be curious about the wanting itself, watching that. This was a strong encouragement of the Buddha around looking at suffering to see what's the structure inside the suffering. The suffering is not necessarily the not having. So one of the things I want to point to here around this understanding of suffering, this teaching around the craving that's connected with suffering, is that whenever we are suffering, there's something that wants to be understood. There is a way when we're I mentioned that the craving is kind of based in a misunderstanding about where happiness lies. And as the Buddha began looking at this, I mean, that seeing of the craving end, the other piece of that understanding was really, wow, there can be a different kind of happiness that comes when craving releases, that is different than getting something. And so this is the happiness of letting go. This is the happiness of release. And the Buddha discovered or kind of found that there are different kinds of happinesses, maybe deeper kinds of happinesses that are not connected with getting what we want, but are more connected with letting go. And so craving is not going to point us to those kinds of happinesses. It's going to be it's caught in its own belief. And so it's like we have to step outside the realm of that belief in order to see that there are other kinds of happiness that are possible. And so the misunderstanding associated with that craving, I need to get that in order to be happy. I need to get rid of that in order to be happy. That's based in a misunderstanding. And basically, any time we are suffering, there being a craving inside, there's some kind of misunderstanding or misinterpretation, or it's like we're not aligned with the way things actually are. One of the teachings of the Buddha is a kind of a framing of the way things actually are. Impermanent. There's nothing in experience that is permanent, lasting for more than a few moments. There's nothing that's permanent. There's nothing, because there's nothing that's permanent, there's nothing that's reliable as a place for lasting happiness. That, again, that's part of where the misunderstanding of craving is. It's so interesting to see the mind as it's searching for some place to find happiness. Even in some deeper meditation practices where my mind is pretty settled and understands pretty deeply that not going to find happiness in landing on anything, there's still this like deep like view or belief that got to be somewhere out there. There's got to be something to land on where I can find some happiness. And yet that searching for happiness in an unreliable, impermanent world is destined to lead to suffering. And so the when we are suffering, there's something, some way in which we're not understanding something. We're not understanding the impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, not self nature of experience. And it's up in the groups this morning, we were talking about this some, about the feeling of uncontrollability and how that leads to so much vulnerability and a sense of resistance to that uncontrollability. You know, when things feel uncontrollable, it's like the mind goes, no! This is not okay that things are uncontrollable. And we may, you know, can have different reactions there. We may feel like either we're doing something wrong because I can't figure out how to control it, or we feel betrayed by the universe because things are uncontrollable. And again, both of these they're kind of like not aligning with, well, what is the truth here? Things are uncontrollable. And there is a vulnerability. So this is truth. And yet it is very human to not be okay with this truth. I've not met somebody who, from the beginning, you know, seems to have the sense of things as they are. Yeah, I'm okay with that. It's a learning. It is so human to resist impermanence. It is human to resist uncontrollability, to have fear around these things. It is human. You are not alone in this misunderstanding, this resistance. And so again, you know, the work here that we encourage, particularly in this retreat, is when we notice what's happening. So we notice that we experience or we recognize, wow, this is uncontrollable. What's the relationship to it? What's the relationship to uncontrollability? What's the relationship to impermanence? Fear, anger, rage, shame, confusion, hatred. So many different responses. And I find it, at least for myself, when I remember this is human, of course I'm angry about things being uncontrollable. Of course. And yet to not like give in to that anger, but instead to allow that, of course I'm angry. Of course anger arises with uncontrollability. That's a human response. Supporting an ability to, okay, then let's look at this human experience of anger. Uncontrollability is here. Anger about uncontrollability is here. And what is that human experience? Remembering that everything is allowed in this field of mindfulness. The entirety of our human experience can be brought into the practice. There's nothing that can't be. I really feel that this is it's an honoring of our human experience. Whatever's arising and whatever your relationship to that is, this practice is about honoring that and meeting it. Not to try to fix it or change it or get rid of it, but to understand it. In the realm of our relationships, you know, in terms of really being met, you know, I think we do. In terms of belonging, in terms of wanting to be in a community, and we want to be met, we want to be understood. This, when we are met, when we are understood, it feels like love, it feels like compassion, it feels like, okay, I can be here with this. Somebody can be here with this. And we can do that internally, and we need to do that internally. To open, to understand suffering. We have to meet it. The meeting of that suffering, when we do come in contact with it, without, you know, when we come into that perspective of allowing, so a right attitude, or, you know, that we recognize, yes, this is happening and it's a human experience. The heart can kind of hold it. It's almost like we get a bigger container in which something is happening, where that bigger container has more space and can hold whatever's going on. And we have that allowing container. That creates the conditions for learning, for understanding that suffering. It creates the conditions for recognizing the views and the beliefs that are underlying that suffering. For recognizing potentially the mistaken perspective that's there. As we see things in that way, and this is one of those paradoxes of practice. You know, we can't want to, that the motivation for our practice really is about learning and understanding. It's about getting to know something really well. But the paradox about getting to know something really well is it's got a new, it creates a new alchemy. It changes things to get to know things really well. When you get to know something really well, there's something new that happens. And often what happens is there's a shift around the suffering. And this is what the Buddha pointed to in his Third Noble Truth, that when that craving releases, when suffering is understood, he framed his Four Noble Truths in a way, there is suffering, and suffering should be understood. That is the first instruction. Understand suffering. So that's really about meeting it. It's not about thinking about it. It's not understanding in our usual way of thinking about, but it is this. What is this human experience of suffering in the moment, the direct experience? That understanding, as we meet it, as we touch it and get to know it, begins to reveal the craving inside. And having that craving be revealed creates the conditions for a release from that craving, which creates the release from the suffering. But the release from the suffering doesn't come because we want the release from the suffering. It comes through the understanding. And so that is really our work, is the understanding. Understanding suffering. Whenever we are suffering, there's something asking to be understood. Something that really is... Whenever there's suffering, it's kind of like there's a pointer to some way in which we are resisting the truth, some way in which we are denying impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. And so this, in many ways, we can recognize when we are suffering, this is an opportunity to see some way in which the mind is not aligning with the truth, not aligning with things as they are. What is there in here that can be understood? There are also things out there that need to be understood. Definitely there are things out there that need to be understood. And in fact, at times, so, you know, we can use our own suffering as kind of a pointer. You know, our own suffering is a guide in a way. When we are suffering, there's something that's asking for attention. So let's attend to it. So when there's suffering, there's something that wants to be understood internally. And things outside also. You know, when we see suffering externally, or when we see something that happens externally that is creating suffering, that's also worth understanding. So both are worth exploring. I think sometimes that when we see suffering happening around us, you know, it's almost like sometimes we can see there's certain things. Maybe we do something. Maybe we do something out of the goodness of our hearts. You know, we're doing something out of the best of intentions. And it doesn't have the effect that we want. In fact, it creates a big mess. And, you know, we might think, okay, well, my intentions were good, so that big mess isn't my fault. There was a story that I heard on This American Life. It was a story about an improv group called Improv Everywhere, and they would do this kind of improv art in public places, and it was kind of, you know, it was just to see how people respond when unusual things happen. So, you know, it might be something like, one of the things they did was on a subway car, they at one point started handing out paper hats and party favors and, you know, singing happy birthday. That kind of thing, you know, just like, you know, they just get a whole bunch of people together. It's kind of like, what do they call those flash mobs, you know, that just a whole bunch of people come together and do something unusual. One of their improvs that they decided to do was they decided to give this band, a little band that, you know, didn't have much of a, they weren't very well known. They decided, they called this improv, they called it the best gig ever. And they wanted to give this little band the best night of their lives. That was their intention. They really wanted this band to have a great night. And so they found a little tiny band that, you know, had some YouTube videos. And you know, they found out that they were going to be playing in New York City at this little venue. And so, you know, the people doing the improv listened to all the songs, learned all the songs, learned all the words to all the songs, and about 50 of them showed up at this little venue. And, you know, they were pretty much everybody, you know, in the crowd. There were, you know, maybe a half a dozen more people there, but you know, when they started playing, you know, they would sing along, they would mouth the words, you know, they all did their own thing with this. And you know, the band was like, wow, this is so great. You know, these people really love our music, and they had the best night of their lives. You know, it was great. And then a few months later, you know, that this group, Improv Everywhere, posts their work on a website. And so they posted this thing that they did and named the band, and people started, you know, searching that band, and then it got back to the band that night had been a lie, basically. And then there were a whole bunch of people that were trashing them, you know, because they could, you know, they came into public view, you know, the way the internet is. You become a public being and you get a lot of stuff thrown at you. So they had a lot of that thrown at them, and it was devastating for them, both to realize that that had been a lie, but also all of the follow-on stuff. And so the leader of this group, Improv Everywhere, the Ira Glass from This American Life, was interviewing him, and his what he said was, well, our intentions were good. And my heart kind of sunk when I heard that, because my feeling was kind of like, well, yes, your intentions were good, but maybe there's something to learn here. So you didn't want them to suffer. That wasn't your intention, to create that suffering. But that's what happened. And it's worth looking at, what did I not understand? What did I not know? I mean, the first thing to look at is like the entire thing is based in a lie, right there. That's something to look at. And then for me, the other thing I thought of was, you know, the other things that they did, the other things that they described were kind of just more general. You know, it's like whoever happened to be in the subway car got that birthday party, or, you know, whoever happened to be walking down the street got to see people doing jumping jacks in the window of the Whole Foods. You know, it wasn't targeted to individuals. This one was targeted to individuals. And maybe this kind of art should not be done in that way. So, you know, it's just like, maybe there's some things to learn. And when we act in the world and we see this, you know, we see our actions creating things. It's not to beat ourselves up and tell ourselves we're a horrible person, but also not to just say, well, it's not my fault, you know. Not my doing that happened. You know, what is there to learn? What can I learn from this? And so I really think that there's a call for us not only to look internally, but to see how do things land externally. And what can we learn from that? What can we learn from what other people do externally, where suffering is created and how it's created when we see things happening? Maybe we can step in and point something out for somebody. You know, this is not okay. not done out of aversion, but out of understanding and compassion and interest and curiosity. So exploring suffering, you know, this is a lot of what we do here. You know, I used to think in my meditation, I had many retreats where much of the time during the retreat, there was dukkha. 1 3-month course, I pretty much ended up dubbing my self-hatred retreat because so much that was what was coming up during that time. And at the beginning of that retreat, there was a view, there was a belief that, okay, well, they do say this is that I should just notice what's arising and this is what's arising. Sometimes I can be with it, sometimes I can't, you know, seeing the overwhelm of it at times and needing to not be with it. But there was all under that somewhere, under all of the looking at it and being with it, there was the belief that, okay, practice is pretty much on hold until this goes away. That was the belief. That, yep, this is my practice, but not going to deepen in practice. Things aren't going to, I'm not really going to have insights until this goes away. At some point during that retreat, there was more of a shift where there was more, it was kind of surrender in a way. It's like, okay, yeah, I guess this is my self-hatred retreat. Okay, yeah, I'll watch it. I will just really get to know it. And so that belief, I don't think that belief went away fully until a certain moment on the retreat, actually. There was a certain moment in observing the self-hatred where there was a time where the mind could really just be right with it, just look at it, see it arise, notice the just a little putting together of it, seeing a thought in there. At some point, there was this recognition of, oh my gosh, this entire structure of self-hatred is based on a thought. It's just a thought. And in that moment, the whole like structure of self-hatred fell apart. In that moment, there was also the deep recognition and understanding that, wow, that's a powerful recognition of how thoughts create what I'm experiencing. It goes beyond self-hatred. And the realization in that moment was not only something about the self-hatred, but something about the practice being the depth of practice, the depth of understanding, the depth of insight that can happen in the middle of self-hatred. That was the path. That was how that understanding arose, by meeting it. It wasn't that I got to some really peaceful, calm place and then suddenly there was like, oh, thoughts create reality. Like, no, it was right in the middle of seeing it create a mess in the mind. Meeting suffering is not some secondary practice. This is where our insights really can grow. We don't have to wait for our practice to deepen. Wait for the ending of these hindrances for our practice to deepen. The transformation through the being with creates such deep understanding and deep insight. And there's also times that insights happen kind of like in really like ordinary situations. Sayadaw tells this story. I love this story because I told it in one of the groups this morning. He said he was in the shower one day and, you know, just using the soap, and at some point the soap came up near his face and he got a whiff of the soap, and there was this like insight of like, oh, it's the nose that smells. There's a condition there. It's like there's scent and there's a nose and smell happens. Oh my God, this is amazing. Smell happens because of the nose. And he was like running around talking to his family. He's like, did you know it's the nose that smells? He went to his teacher and he told him. He was like running around. He said, people are looking at me like I'm crazy. I'm asking them if they know the nose smells. He says, his teacher said, don't talk to people about those things. You know, these insights can be sound so trivial and so nothing, and just like, you know, but this is another deep understanding, the conditionality of experience. Deep understanding happens because we are present, because we are interested in understanding experience as human experience. It doesn't come because we're looking for it. It doesn't come because we want to have it. It comes because of that continuity of mindfulness and this perspective of curiosity. What is our human experience? Whether that's of suffering, of self-hatred, or whether it's of the concentrated mind, of bliss, of peace, of smell of soap or taste of orange, it does not matter what we are paying attention to. Insight, understanding can happen anytime. The condition is the continuity of mindfulness and this curiosity, this perspective, the perspective of what's this? And so this is our work. You know, this is, and when we talk in the groups, this is what we're interested in hearing about, is like, how is the mindfulness? How are you exploring that? Are you familiar with being aware? What happens when you are mindful? What do you notice? So we're really interested in supporting the conditions for the mindfulness. The rest of it, the mindfulness with this perspective of wisdom. So it's really the two, awareness and wisdom. We're interested in supporting the cultivation of awareness from a perspective of wisdom. And the rest of it is not our business. We get to experience the results of it. The rest of it happens very naturally. But we don't make it happen. So let's sit for a couple of minutes.